yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today's show, of course, has to be an update of what's going on in the global economy as a result of the coronavirus. How much is contagion actually occurring? And I mean not just contagion biologically. I mean economic contagion. And what are the economic channels by which the crisis in the China economy, and it is a crisis, propagates across the global economy to other economies, first in Asia, and then, of course, in Europe and North America? But that's the topic of the day that's of great import here. And also, if we have time after that, I want to say a few things about what's going on in Japan and Europe, the weak sisters of the global economy, you might say. And then corporate bonds, the crisis coming in corporate bonds globally. And then if we have time, I want to say a few things about the Democratic Party debates here on the eve of the caucus in Nevada, and then, of course, subsequently in South Carolina, and then what they call Super Tuesday. What's beginning to emerge as a crisis in the Democratic Party itself? Okay, let's start from the beginning. What's happened here in the past week? Well, you know, when this coronavirus began in China, the consensus among investors, particularly in the U.S., was that it was going to be short and sweet. Well, maybe not sweet, but short. What was going to happen was a contraction in China. But policies would soon reverse that after 3 to 6 months, and we would then see a snapback in China, and of course globally. We would get a V-shaped recovery. That was the first assumption, and you could hear it on talking heads all across the media, and you know, in the print press and everywhere. That was, you know, that was the consensus. Oh, it's going to be V-shaped. In other words, a sharp downturn, but a sharp snapback and recovery, and by the second half of the year, the recovery would be full. The other assumption was that it wasn't going to spread very, very much outside of China. It would be contained in China. Well, we see now in the past week, both of those assumptions are collapsing. And those who've been arguing V-shape are wrong. And we can see the markets, investors and stock markets and so forth, bond markets reflecting that reluctant awareness that what we have here is something that is a systemic, potentially systemic capitalist economy, global systemic risk. And it's not something that is temporary and relatively benign in the long run. Well, what's happened? Let's look at some of the changes that have occurred with regard to the virus and its spread that have undermined this twin consensus of, V-shaped and, it won't spread very much in the West. Well, what we've got here the past week is that China keeps changing its estimation and its method of the infection rate in China and the death rate. Well, you can't change the death rate too much. I mean, you're either dead or you're not, right? But the infection rate has been upped several times. And that has created doubt about the figures, whether they are accurate or not. You know, the officially today, by today, is somewhere between 75,000 and 80,000 cases, most of them in China, and most of those in the Hubei province, where Wuhan, the city of the origin of the virus, has occurred. So the question is, you know, is it spreading and at what rate outside of Hubei, elsewhere in China? And then the second, is it spreading beyond China? Well, you know, the fact that the rate of infection is being doubted now is significant. I mean, look, even in, you've got a virtual quarantine going on in Wuhan, and who knows, probably elsewhere in that province. People are told and are staying indoors in their apartments. They're not going out. Who knows what the infection rate is behind those apartment doors? It's almost impossible with a city of that size to get a good idea of how much infection unrecorded exists. You know, people can have symptoms and get tested, and that adds to the infection rate or population, infected population number. People can have symptoms and not yet tested. And then, of course, people could have the virus and show no symptoms. So the numbers keep changing as those latter categories begin to reveal that there's more infection than people are saying. Beijing, now, all of a sudden last week, the infection rate went up sharply, like a rise in four times the infection rate the week before. So the numbers of infected are rising in Beijing, and there's some other provinces as well in South China where the same thing is happening. Infection rate is going up. Interestingly as well, South Korea, all of a sudden now we have a sharp increase in South Korea, over 200 cases as of yesterday, but that's a doubling in one day. So, in other words, the virus has a toehold in South Korea, and the result is that infection rates are rising. Or as a epidemiology professor at the university there in South Korea, Kim Woo-ju, said, the 200 is just the tip of the iceberg, unquote. And what about Japan? Japan, of course, the rate jumped significantly here by allowing the infected cruise ship, the Diamond Princess, to eject hundreds of its passengers. 621 last heard of the 3,700 passengers and crew members have the virus, right? They've tested about 3,100, but the 621 have the virus. And there was a Japanese doctor, epidemiologist again, who went on board and who just tweeted that the ship was an incubation ship. You know, the procedures that were applied were totally inadequate, and in some ways actually increased the infection rate. What you got, of course, is that in a lot of places in China, and in this case of this cruise ship, you have non-medical people trying to establish procedures and protocols to protect others from the spread of the virus who don't know what they're doing, you see. The bureaucrats don't know. They're not medical. They don't know how really to stop this. And they do things that actually make things worse. That ship, Diamond Princess, was an incubation ship, you might say. And okay, so they released 621 of these people, American consulate has arranged for the Americans there. There's several dozen, I think, to fly back and be quarantined in the U.S. But the point is, quarantining may actually help spread the virus by quarantining people in a non-medical way. It puts people closer together, and it actually spreads the virus in some ways. The director general of the World Health Organization last week said the virus will spread to the rest of the world. It hasn't spread yet, but it is about to. In other words, the medical experts, are singing a different story than what you're getting in a lot of the media. And another editorial in the Wall Street Journal by, I believe, a medical expert said that the 14-day quarantine period is not necessarily safe. In other words, it's been bandied about that, if we quarantine you for 14 days and you don't have it, then you're safe. We can put you out, back in the public. That may not be true. That 14-day period may not be safe. We have this problem of what looks like a spread going on now. The lack of reporting, I think, of those who've been put in quarantine in the U.S. at various Air Force bases, in Texas and California and so forth, we're getting no actual information and reports on what's the status of those people. Are they infected? Are they not infected? Have certain people been released? People they've come in contact with are potential infected. And the policy of the United States is to send them home and say, stay in your home voluntarily. Stay away from people. So how many people do we have who are potentially infected, just hasn't shown up yet, who have been sent home and told to voluntarily quarantine yourself? Well, voluntary quarantine, forget it. We don't know. Again, it's policies and protocols being put in place by bureaucrats, not medical people. As for the contagion going on, these cruise ships, the Diamond Princess and Westerdam, I think it was, where its entire passengers have been put off in Cambodia, I believe it was. No other country would accept them. We aren't hearing anything about that, right? How many were infected and not that were released? That's a big question mark, right? Let me say something about the death rate. You hear another spin of this whole thing in the media that, the death rate is low. Only 2.5% of those infected actually die, right? But you got to remember that low death rate is because you have a very high contagion infection rate. Maybe by the time you listen to this, there's 80,000 cases. It's rising thousands every day. And about 2,500 deaths. So when you get that kind of a range of infected to death with a high infection rate, the death rate tends to be low. But in absolute terms, the death rate is really quite high, and the infection rate with this virus is also extremely high. Compare it to the SARS virus, another coronavirus that occurred in China in 2002 or 2003. Over the course of a year and the whole lifespan of the virus, 774 people died. So 12 months for 774. 2 months now for 2,500, 2 months here with the coronavirus. But yet all of this V-shaped snapback media spin is based upon the SARS virus experience. Well, this is not the SARS virus. This is something that's far more infectious, very, very easily infected, unlike back in 2002 and 2003, right? And some epidemiologists have estimated that the real cases are probably five times that being reported, five times. You know, so if that means there's 80,000 deaths by this weekend, that means that, there could be hundreds of thousands, 300,000, 400,000 actual infected, if they are correct, right? Some really draconian reporting is that China has delivered to Hubei province portable incinerators, about a half a dozen portable mass incinerators. China says it's for dead animals. Well, come on, you know. I think they understand that their hospitals are overloaded and that they're going to find people in their apartments who had already perished, and that, there's no place to quickly bury people like that. You know, it's incineration for the bodies. Okay. We don't have any information about freight shipping here that are held out of ports, cancellations of freight shipping sailings. I mean, what's really getting in China or getting out as far as freight shipping? I'm talking about ocean-borne shipping here. These are all quite negative developments, some of them anecdotal, but when you put it all together, what you get a picture of is this thing is not it's not mitigating. This thing is beginning to accelerate. And, of course, when it accelerates, the whole V-shaped story pretty much evaporates. Okay, so let's talk about the economic contagion. As terrible as the biological is, you know, from an economist's point of view, I'm more interested, perhaps, in the economic channels of contagion. We can identify at least a half a dozen channels by which the economic effects in China get propagated to other economies and to the rest of the world, global economy. All right, so what are these channels? Well, you know, the first obvious is the supply chain trade channel. Countries like Japan and Korea and the U.S., and Europe to a lesser extent, have moved their production to China to take advantage of the lower costs and so forth, less regulation, et cetera. Japan and South Korea especially have moved a lot of their manufacturing. We hear about the U.S. manufacturing supply chain moved to significantly in a number of areas. I mean, like Apple manufactures all its iPhones over there, all the parts and everything come from China. So when you disrupt that supply chain, and actually it's more than a disruption, it's kind of like a severing of the supply chain. When that production in China stops, then production in turn will stop in Japan because the parts are made in China. And if the parts aren't delivered, you can't continue production in Japan. That's a significant effect, the supply chain. There's other ways that the virus and China's contracting economy affect Japan. We'll talk about that because Japan's in a recession now. What a time for this thing to hit Japan. We'll talk about that once we get through this. But the U.S. as well. 49% of all U.S. imports from China to the U.S. are from U.S. companies in partnership production, but nonetheless U.S. companies in China. 49% of the imports. Yeah. So it's a big effect on certain areas in the U.S. will start having a bigger effect. And I might say on North America, on the NAFTA integrated economies. the same thing with Europe, particularly Germany, which is also already stagnant and declining in some ways. In other words, Germany, EU and Germany in particular, depend upon the supply chain of companies, German companies, that have moved to China. And that's being disrupted now as well. Okay. So as far as the U.S., you know, you have output destined for exports to China, in other words, U.S.-made goods to be exported to China, that's going down. Why? Because there's simply a decline in China demand for exports. China has been turning away ships coming to its ports, particularly you know, commodities and oil and gas and so forth, as well as in intermediate goods, because if their production has slowed or stopped, then they don't want the parts. They don't want because it's just surplus. It'll just pile up, and they don't take delivery. In other words, how much of that is going on? How much of non-delivery of imports from the U.S. you know, is going on, and from the rest of the world, you know, Australia being affected greatly that way as well, because a lot of commodities from Australia are shipped to China. Its economy has become increasingly linked and dependent upon China. Right? So output from the U.S. to China, negatively affected. Output dependent in China on parts and intermediate goods to the U.S., well, if there's no production going on, it's not going to be shipped to the U.S., and as a result, the U.S. is not only losing exports production, but imports from China are slowing production for required parts from China. Right? And, of course, will China continue to purchase U.S. energy, oil and gas, that was part of this mini trade deal? You know, the estimates were, the most positive estimates, optimistic, were that China would in this year, 2020, import from the U.S. About $20-25 billion in oil and gas imports. Well, if China is turning away, oil and gas shipping into China, saying we're not taking it, do you think they're going to continue importing U.S. Oil and gas as well, or nevertheless? No. In other words, this mini trade deal is crumbling. It wasn't much to begin with, but, you know, Trump has argued, oh, $100 billion this year and $100 billion next year, they're going to buy from us as part of the deal. Well, economists have estimated that by the time it got going here, it would only be $73 billion. But that was before the hit of the virus and the fact that the imports are not going to occur. So, you know, it'd be lucky if $20-30 billion actually occurs in increased purchases by China as a result of the mini deal. So that's the supply chain, the trade chain contagion. In other words, the lack of parts made in China necessary for production in the U.S. Will have an economic contagion effect on the U.S. and the fact that the U.S. Exports to China are no longer needed in the volume they once were because the production in China has pretty much shut down in lots of places. And that's a channel. And that channel, by the way, in that sense, applies to South Korea and Japan even more greatly, and Germany and Europe and the rest of the world. All right, that's the supply trade channel, contagion channel. There's another channel, the currency channel. As China's economy flattens out, stagnates, I think it may even contract here, what you're seeing already is a devaluation, a natural devaluation of its currency, the yuan or the renminbi, whatever is the name they call it for offshore, it's offshore currency. That's already devaluing, you see. And, of course, if it devalues beyond 7.1, which it is, 7 yuan to the dollar, which is about 12.5 cents to the dollar. Yuan's about 12.5 cents. If that continues to devalue and it broke through its range of 7 to 1, that has an effect on the U.S. and on emerging markets. If China's currency devalues, other currencies in emerging markets will devalue even more because, there's no demand for their commodities and intermediate goods, but action is taken usually by the governments to ensure that their currency does not remain high while the China's currency devalues. So other currencies, Latin America, Argentine peso, Brazil real, and so forth. In Asia, the Thai baht currency. All those devalue. Now, when those currencies devalue, what you get is capital flight to the U.S. as investors dump their currencies, which are falling in value, in other words, wiping out profits, or getting negative profits, they want to get out of those kinds of investments, both in financial markets and in real investments. They want to convert those currencies into U.S. dollars because dollars are rising in value. You make a profit by holding dollars. You make a loss by holding your own devaluing currency. That's called capital flight, and that capital flight comes to the U.S., it drives up the value of the dollar even more. And that's what's going on, you see. In the first 2 months of this year, well, not even 2 months yet, the U.S. dollar has risen about 3.5 to 4%. That doesn't sound like much, but it really is. Because when last summer it rose to 8%, it played a big role in precipitating a major stock contraction in August, if you remember. That pretty much coincided with Trump's imposing more tariffs as the trade war negotiations were intensifying, more tariffs on China. Those two events caused the market to contract sharply. Trump quickly stepped in, and the U.S. stepped in and said, no, we won't impose the tariffs as bad as we are. Of course, the dollar reversed its climb. Well, after 2 months, we're facing potentially the same thing in the next month or two. And we're already seeing the rising dollar due to this indirect effect, devaluation of the yuan, devaluation of other emerging market economies, flowing back to the U.S., driving up the demand for the dollar and raising the dollar. We see that beginning to happen again, like it did last summer, and it could be even worse. And I don't think the rising dollar has to even get to 8% for the stock market in the U.S. to start a big contraction. Already, we see its equity stock markets in the U.S. are hovering on a contraction. Here, they're beginning to turn down, if it goes much further, they'll turn down even faster. Okay. By the way, here's a side statistic regarding the equity markets. Whenever more than 60% of investors interviewed continue to believe that the stock market will continue to rise, that's always been an indicator of a major correction and contraction about to happen. Well, surveys show that 66% of investors believe stocks will continue to rise in the U.S. this year. 66%. Four times previously, when that number of expectation rose above 60%, and now it's 66, we've always had a major contraction. We may be on the cusp of a major contraction in the stock market in the U.S., if that statistic is right. Okay, so we have this currency channel and the rising dollar and collapsing currencies in emerging markets, capital flight to the U.S. to hold safe haven, treasury bonds, and so forth, drives up the price of the treasury bond and drives down the rate, the bond rate, the yield, the interest rate for treasuries, which is happening right now this week, just about daily, right? Now, capital flight out of emerging markets, usually those countries attempt to try to stem the outflow by raising their own interest rates. In other words, if you're looking, investor in Argentina, if you're looking to save your money from devaluing peso currency, invest in securities and treasuries, the equivalent treasuries in Argentina. Don't send the money out to the U.S., right? Invest here. But if they invest in those kinds of securities, it causes a slowdown of their own domestic economy. And that's what's happening. The interest rate in Argentina, I think, is 40%. You can get 40% of your money by putting it in Argentine government securities, government bonds, in other words, as a safe haven. It's all about trying to stem the outflow. And also another bad effect is when the currencies collapse in these emerging market economies, the cost of imports, the inflation for imports accelerate. So what you get is a slowing economy, more layoffs, more recession amidst accelerating price hikes. We used to call that stagflation. Well, it's not stagnant, it's recession-flation. All that is beginning to appear in emerging markets. And also, if you are in an emerging market and you're a business or investor there and you borrowed in dollars, right? You borrowed dollars, issued bonds in dollars, corporate bonds in dollars, in the past. As the dollar rises, you have to pay back more of your own currency to continue to service your principal and interest on your dollarized debt. Now, emerging market total denominated dollar debt today is $6.5 trillion. So as the dollar rises, you get increasingly businesses that borrowed in dollars that aren't able to pay the principal and interest, you get defaults. And defaults start a problem all of their own. It becomes very psychologically contagious for all investors, and they all pull back, and the recession gets worse in those economies. Well, you can see how the currency channel is very important. We have this potential chain of events of the yuan, Chinese yuan, devaluing, causing the dollar to rise, causing emerging market currencies to fall, and ultimately deepening crises in these emerging market economies, both in terms of inflation and recession and debt default. Okay. And remember, the indicator here is the dollar, having risen 4% so far in just 2 months. All right. So that's the second channel, currency channel. The third channel is global oil deflation. And its impact not only on the real economy, but on the financial asset called oil futures. You see, that's a financial asset. China has turned away ships delivering oil and energy that it had ordered and has the right to do that under contracts that contain, and they all contain, a reference to what's called the force majeure, meaning acts of God. In other words, we have no way to control this. This thing has happened, in this case, the virus, and we're not honoring our contract. We're not taking the delivery. How many of these oil tankers out there are just, you know, hovering offshore the ports? No one knows. At least I don't know how serious that may be. And by the way, that's true for other ships that just aren't allowed to land in port. And by the way, probably don't want to. Deliver other commodities, you know, iron ore, copper ore, and so forth. Who knows what that picture looks like? Well, when you get oil deflation like that, it's really an indicator of commodities, industrial commodities deflation, you know, coal, iron, copper, and so forth. They're falling as well. We have this precipitous decline, already 20% in oil, global crude oil, and the declines in copper and other industrial commodities. Not just the fact that that's not being used, those commodities aren't being used in production, but on the financial asset side of these commodities, commodity futures, we get significant price deflation. Now, that affects investors in general. They see deflating prices. They want to pull out of those sectors. And it has a dampening effect on all financial asset investing. So we need to watch commodities deflation, oil and commodities deflation contagion as well. That's the third channel. Fourth channel is the financial asset markets in general. China economy and its stock markets contracted sharply here. To some extent, the government has pumped in all kinds of cheap money to try to, put a floor under that, and it's recovered a little bit. But the long-term trend is very clearly that the markets are, financial asset markets, equity markets, stock markets are going to decline and contract. And you can see it spilling over already to the financial centers nearby, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, Japan, even Australia. Financial markets are declining there as a result of the decline in financial markets in China and the situation in general in China. And the currencies, by the way, of those same countries are slowing or declining. You know, Australia dollar, Singapore, Japan, Japan's yen. You know, the yen, which usually in these kinds of situations, a global slowdown, it becomes a safe haven. In other words, just as the dollar becomes a preferred place to put your liquid funds, sell your own currencies and investments and put them in the dollar, as I said, but also similarly the yen, the Japanese yen currency. But that's not happening now. No, because the very clearly Japan's economy is in a deep problem here, and that outweighs the problem of the safe haven. Who wants to put their investments in yen when the Japanese economy is softening and long run forcing the yen to decline? There's another channel here besides the financial asset market channel, because global financial markets are all connected, right? And the debt is between the investors is all connected. These are the same people investing in financial asset markets around the world, and they move their money from one market in one country to another market overnight, instantaneously. So if you've got problems with debt and debt is interlinked globally, well, you know, it propagates from debt problems in one country to other countries as well. Okay, and the fifth channel I would say is the consumption channel, tourism, luxury goods, right? Chinese buyers and tourists have up until now really flooded economies in countries like Japan, the United States, and Europe. Well, that's totally dried up. Chinese buyers are not coming to these countries. And, of course, that has an effect on consumption demand in these countries, the U.S. In particular, but Japan especially as well, and to some extent Europe. So that's a way that, consumption channel, you might say, luxury goods as well. You know, Chinese are buying fewer luxury goods from the West. That impacts, of course, Germany and Europe in particular. But if you look at what are the industries and sectors globally that are being negatively impacted because of the news and the supply chain, because of tourism, because of luxury goods and so forth, well, airlines for sure, right? No flights in and out, and even internal travel by airlines in China. And already China has started bailing out its airlines. Hotels, resorts, cruise ships, not sailing. No one wants to sit on a cruise ship. You don't know who in the culinary food gallery might be infected and passing it on. In fact, there's some rumors that the Diamond Princess infection rate got so high because you had ship staff who were infected in food processing and preparation. So resorts, cruise ships, trade shows, shipbuilding, both shipbuilding for passenger ships and shipbuilding for freight. It may be a sharp downturn in sea travel here, and of course, building of container ships or tanker ships has already begun to have an effect. You know, global trade was already just about flat last year, and now we have this hitting it. So global trade will contract probably for the first time since we've been keeping records. Well, maybe it happened in 2008. I'm not sure. Okay. Another big channel, a sixth channel here, is Japan. Japan's GDP in the fourth quarter of last year contracted 6.3% already before the virus. Okay, so it's going to be another quarter for sure, even worse. Germany and France, no growth, essentially stagnant. And then, of course, emerging market commodity producers, oil and other commodities, either already in recession, right? But in particular, Japan, the growth is going to be significantly declining here and continuing to significantly decline. Okay, what are some of the assessments of what's happening to the global economy here? Well, Goldman Sachs predicts that the virus effect in China and supply chain and tourism and all the other things that's going to propagate through. The U.S. Will lose 0.6% off of first quarter this year GDP, 0.6%. Well, if the growth is about, officially even 2%, well, that's reduces it to 1.4. Actually, I think the U.S. growth before accounting for this effect is going to be closer to 1.5. So that if this effect continues, which of course it will through March, it could lower the U.S. growth rate to 1% or less. We see oil demand contracting the most since 2009. The price of oil has dropped from $70 to the low $50 a barrel. Freight costs for dry bulk shipping carriers, in other words, grain shipping, iron shipping, coal shipping, and so forth, has turned negative the first time since 1999 when stats were begun. Okay, China's share of the global GDP now, you know, somewhere around 16-18%. Well, when it was only 4% of global GDP in 2003, it knocked off 2 percentage points of growth rate there in China. And now, it, in other words, China plays a bigger role in the global economy, so its effect on that global economy will be greater. Goldman Sachs, by the way, said that, quote, the risks of a correction, a stock correction, are high, unquote, in the U.S., right? Because of the hit that's going to occur directly on profits of U.S. companies and thus their stock prices, and indirectly from rising currency dollar for their international operations offshore. The IMF has called for a coordinated global preparation and response. Yeah, you don't see too much of that being reported. The S&P index here, S&P, which is a big research, kind of Standard & Poor's research, right, predicts a surge of more than $1 trillion in bad loans in China. A trillion. And if those loans go default in China, that will send a psychological message around the world about corporate loans and defaults. You remember I said emerging markets are holding $6.5 trillion in dollar-denominated loans and bonds. Okay. The estimation number of sources is that the China factories are operating at about 50% on average. 50%. It's half shut down. Half of the manufacturing economy is shut down. Okay, so what that's going to do for China GDP? Well, you know, it's fourth quarter official was 6%, but we know that's artificially high. Independent sources say it was about 4% last quarter, and now it's going to contract and under the virus here significantly. As I've said before, I think the rate will be somewhere between 0 and 2% growth this quarter, from 6% officially to really 2% at best case. China's central bank has already cut interest rates, both on short-term and longer-term loans here, rate loans, and is targeting extra money into banks and regions, you know, like Hubei province, giving preferential loans to small, medium businesses directly affected and to expand healthcare companies and so forth. So, you know, we got manufacturing centers, not just Hubei, which is manufacturing province, but also outside Shanghai, Beijing, Shandong, internal travel down, property, local government problems here, financing debt, energy, retail. All of these are hitting China pretty hard in its economy. And it's spilling over significantly, I think, to Japan. That's the country and economy to watch as potentially the most seriously harmed here within the next month or two, because it's already significantly fragile. Back in October, Japan raised its sales tax. Once again, it did it before, and that sent the economy in a tailspin. Contraction, like I said, GDP contracted on an annual basis in the fourth quarter, -6.3%. Really, the worst since 2014, largely because of the sales tax and also problems with investment over there. China is Japan's largest trading partner. It's not the U.S., it's Japan. As I said, they moved a lot of their supply chain to northern China. Japan gets a lot of tourists from China. Japan's tourist industry, 31 million visitors a year. 10 million of them are from China. Well, those folks aren't coming. They're not going to be let in. They're not coming. And already, just in 1 month, cancellation of 400,000 visitors from China to Japan. Well, that's going to really whack China's consumption side of its economy. Tourism is just pretty much dried up. And we see the because of the collapse of tourism and the supply chain in Japan, on top of the trade war that Trump had pushed on the rest of the economy last year, on top of the value-added tax hike in Japan, now the yen, the currency, is falling. In other words, investors are betting Japan is going to be in serious problems here. Or as the chief economist for the UBS Bank of Global Bank said, quote, it's very, very weak, dismal, shockingly bad, unquote, the condition in Japan, the economy in Japan. Right? Falling yen, right? Supply chain, tourism, business investment. In the fourth quarter, already contracted at 14% on an annualized basis, and consumption contracted 11% on an annualized basis. And the policy response, lowering rates, putting money in the economy. Well, rates are already down to 0.1% interest rates in Japan. That's not going to stimulate anything. In other words, Japan is one of the best examples of how monetary policy is now up against a wall, absolutely no effect. Now they'll pump more money into the stock market. Stocks may recover, but the real economy won't. And fiscal stimulus, the other alternative, it's not tax cuts because they raise taxes. Government spending on infrastructure, for example, which has been occurring. they passed a stimulus bill in December. Hasn't even taken effect yet. So what? They're going to pass another one on top of it, not even knowing what the first one is going to do? Don't look for much real fiscal stimulus. There'll be another token add-on program. And monetary policy stimulus is totally dead and ineffective. So this economic recession in Japan could go very deep here. Now that we got this overlay of this systemic risk here of China's economy coming to a halt, virtual halt here, when it's responsible for almost a fifth of the global GDP. It's not just Japan. I think it's going to be the rest of the world economy as well going to be seriously affected here. And then, of course, Japan's public debt is 240% of GDP, the highest in the world. Okay, so, the picture does not look very good for Japan. Japan is now the weakest sister in the global economy, and it's certainly going to be impacted here. Europe, is not much better off. It's pretty much stagnant, particularly in Germany. Industrial production dropped 4% last year in Europe, in the Eurozone, concentrated in Germany and in France. And, of course, they've got their overlay of the Brexit situation on top of that. So don't look for any recovery and look for a recession in Europe, I believe, this year as a result of this precipitating factor called the coronavirus and the shutdown of half of the China economy. How will the U.S. fare in all of this? Well, a lot of money's flowing back into the U.S. And driving up the dollar. Well, that's going to make U.S. exports less competitive. It's going to offset Trump's tariffs. So what we'll see here very soon is probably Trump leaning hard once again on the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates once again. But the monetary stimulus channel is not working. You know, they've you can expect more QE and so forth. And the Fed is already pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into the repo market, as we've talked about. So it's got a QE already going. But it doesn't stimulate the real economy. Well, yet you got all the consumers in the U.S. saying, oh, things aren't all that bad. Consumption's the only thing holding up the U.S. economy. Well, you know, there's some defense spending going, increases going on, but that doesn't have the effect it used to in years past. And the tax cuts are not producing any real investment. Trump's tax cuts, you know, real investment's contracting for 9 months now. Manufacturing is contracting for 6 months now. Okay, a little bit as rates fall, a little bit growth in the residential mortgages, but existing homes and new homes, that's petering out as well. So the picture, you know, the U.S. is getting softer, weaker, but it's the best compared to all these other places around the world. So, you know, dollars, capital flights into the U.S., or what Trump called the wall of money, continues. Okay, I want to say something about the closing here in the last few minutes about this debate. What you see going on in the debates here, you know, right before the Nevada caucus of the Democrat candidates is the following. This is a significant development, I believe. What you see, who are the leaders? Well, the leaders are two candidates who aren't really in the mainstream of Democratic Party. You know, you got Bernie Sanders on the left, who isn't even officially a Democrat, right? But they've allowed him to play a role in the debate simply because, you know, he has such a following of Democratic Party members and the populace. So here's the guy on the left fringe is the leader in terms of polls. And now you got a guy on the right fringe who's not a Democrat either. He's a Republican. I'm talking about Bloomberg, right, who is now the boy that they're counting on. The strategy of the Democratic Party is to keep all the votes split, prevent Sanders in particular, but no one from getting the nomination based upon these primaries and the candidates they win in the primaries. Prevent that. And take it to the convention in Milwaukee, where the leadership, the money bags of the Democratic Party. Straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.